Hey, bub, welcome back to a brand new episode of Talkin' Snicked, the Wolverine Show. It's the best podcast there is at what it does, and what it does best talks about Wolverine. I'm your host, Ryan, and today's episode is a special episode. I'm not covering, well, maybe not, but I'm not particularly covering anything X-Men or even Wolverine related. Today, I have on a very special guest. I'm very excited to talk to this guy, because he is a font of knowledge, and he had the chance of growing up in the gold and silver age of comics. So my guest on today's episode is my dad, Chris. Dad, welcome to Talkin' Snicked.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it, Rye. I'm looking forward to talking about my experiences with comics back in the 50s and 60s with you.
So just some brief information about my background in comics. I know that people who have been listening to this podcast for a long time have probably heard me tell my story of how I became an X-Men fan, how I became a Wolverine fan. And if they've listened to my Saturday morning Snicktoons sister series as well, I've had my sister Ariana on, and we've kind of talked about how we began collecting comics and how we got into just being nerds overall. But one of the big things that I rarely ever talk about is prior to my X-Men fandom, which kind of blossomed when I was about 6 years old in like 1991, even predating the 90s animated series, I was very much aware of the big DC superheroes, Superman and Batman. And a big reason for that is the Max Fleischer Superman cartoons, the Adam West Batman live-action series from the 60s. And, Dad, you had these two, like, big hardback editions that were Superman and Batman stories through the ages, and it collected random stories from the 40s, 50s, I think all the way through the 70s. And that's really kind of what kickstarted my fandom into comic books. But you were around kind of not necessarily at the start, because, you know, you weren't alive prior to 1938 with Superman and all that, but you were around as a child for the kicking off of the Silver Age in the mid-50s. So why don't you kind of walk me through some of your earliest memories with comic books back in the 1950s?
When I was about 4 years old, we had just moved to Sunnyvale. We had lived in Alameda. I mean, I was learning my alphabet and making attempts to learn how to read, but I was really interested in what we call the funny papers. So before I could read, we would get the San Jose Mercury News on Sunday mornings. It was a 300 plus page edition. It had all these inserts, and one of the big inserts were the comics, what we called the funny papers. And they were in color, you know, they were huge. There were a lot of things to look at. And even though I couldn't read the stories, I'd look at the pictures and I'd kind of make up my own stories with it. But the routine was Sunday, we'd go to church really early, come home, have breakfast, look at the comics, and then off we'd go. They'd pack us into the car and we'd drive up the peninsula to Burlingame, which is a little bit south of San Francisco. And our cousins, Lou and Ida, took the newspaper there. Was the San Francisco Examiner. And of course, they had their comic insert, but they were pretty much different from what we had with the Mercury. So it was all these other kind of comics. And the things we would look at were some of these things I think most people remember. Dick Tracy, Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers, Tarzan, things like that. But we also, back in the early 50s, we still saw a lot of ethnic humor. It was acceptable back then. Today, we would call it racist. But the ones I remember was something called the Cats and Jammer Kids, and they spoke in broken German, and they would always get into troubles and things and the problems and things like that. But Little Orphan Annie, Popeye, Archie, those were all in our funny papers, our comics. Then after we spent some time with Lou and Ida, we'd go across the Bay Bridge to see my grandmother in Oakland. Well, she had the Oakland Tribune for her paper, and again, a lot of different stuff. So we were exposed at a very young age to all these comics through the funny papers. Maybe a year or two later, my mom would go to the grocery store and come back. She'd buy two comic books for each of us. So there'd be six comic books that we would take turns picking who was first and second and third and whatnot. Of course, by the end of the day, we were exchanging the things. And we'd stack these things on the back of the toilet. So when we had to go visit the Thunder Jug, we had a lot of comic books there with us. That's when I was introduced to Superman, Batman. Those were my big favorites. You know, we saw other things. A lot of them, Peanuts, you know. We had Little Abner. We had all of the Disney characters. We also, of course, you had to have your military stuff. So we had Sergeant Rock and Combat Casey. And those were serious war kind of stories. And then there was Beetle Bailey, who was also in the Army. He was kind of a goof-off. And then we had Woody Woodpecker and Dennis the Menace, things of that nature. So if you picture back in the early 1950s to mid-1950s, what kind of entertainment was there for kids? Well, not much. Television was in its infancy, so there was not very much programming, not very much for children. Saturday morning cartoons was about it, and I think the Mickey Mouse Club came on in afternoons in the mid-50s, but there wasn't much in the way of television entertainment. We didn't have, it was a small town. Sunnyvale was a very, very tiny little town, so there weren't a lot of places to go. Our parents would take us to the movies every Saturday. We were there all day, and of course cartoons were up there on the screen. And a lot of the cartoons were in the comics as well. So there was that crossover. But we would trade. We had a lot of children on our street. So we'd trade or we'd borrow, exchange, whatever. And even you could go to the library. Sunnyvale Library had a comics section. You could check out comics there. We earned a little allowance every week, probably 25 cents or whatever. Sounds ridiculous now, but but back then you could actually get, you know, you could buy comics for 5 or 10 cents. I think for 35 cents, they'd have the big, thick ones. And so, you know, we would use our allowance to buy baseball cards and comics. And the kids would trade those and whatnot. As I got a little bit older, we're still in the 50s. We had comic book store in downtown Sunnyvale. It was called Pete's Smoke Shop. So you'd go down there, and of course they had all their tobacco products, but they had big magazine sections, and that's where I got introduced to pulp fiction, pulp magazines that date way back. I think pulp magazines go back to the 19th century, and so that was a whole bunch of different characters. That's where I saw Tarzan. We had things like Tales from the Crypt. We had Weird Tales. We had The Spirit, which was my all-time favorite next to Superman and Batman. There were stories called Amazing Stories, which were sci-fi kinds of things. Argosy had Adventure, Sword and Sorcery, all kinds of things of that nature, what we would call action movie kind of things, I guess, now. But the pulp fiction also introduced me to Robert E. Howard, who was the creator of Conan the Barbarian and Cole the Conqueror. There was also things by, well, you could get a magazine that was about Westerns. You know, so you had your Wyatt Earp and your Lone Ranger and Roy Rogers, guys like that. They had detective volumes, so you were exposed to Sam Spade, Philip Marlowe, the Falcon, people like that. A lot of those pulp stories found their way into radio shows. So when we first moved to Sunnyvale in the early 50s, we didn't have a television. We had a radio. It was a big old piece of furniture. It was good size. And it was all, there was nothing that was solid state or electronics like we have now. It had things that would take 10 or 15 minutes to warm up, tubes and things like that. So you'd turn it on about 15 minutes before your show came on. And a lot of the things that we were reading in the magazines, there were radio shows, which eventually became, and, you know, in the early 50s, they started transitioning radio shows into television shows. In the early 50s, Superman TV show came on, which you guys could probably go out and see. This is with George Reeves as Superman. Mm-hmm. And I think it went for about 5 or 6 seasons. And at first it was black and white, and then it became color. But you can see those today on like MeTV and some of the other broadcast networks that have all of the shows from the 50s and 60s. And I mean, they're laughable now if you watch them. I mean, you were talking about being introduced to Batman with the Adam West TV series in the late 60s. And as a child, you probably enjoyed those quite a bit. I know Kathy, who's 10 years younger than me, she loves those shows. She watches them all the time still. For me, they were a little bit too campy. I was 18 when that thing came out, that series, and I thought they were a little bit silly, but I enjoy watching them now. And of course, then they evolved into the various Batman films that we still see coming out in the theater and in streaming. I would say that comic books for all of us kids of that era were a huge thing, because there wasn't that much entertainment available to us. And most parents back then would encourage their kids to read, even if it was comic books. You know, there was a big push by some of the people, the conservative people in the 50s, to ban comic books because they were evil and they were filled with violence and that sort of thing. Well, you look at cartoons for kids back then with Daffy Duck or the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote, and even the Disney ones. There's a lot of violence in those comics.
Oh yeah.
But anyway, as I got a little bit older and we got into the 60s, you know, when I got a paper route and I had even more, I think I was making $40 a month as a paper boy. You could get a lot of comics for that amount of money. And a lot of baseball cards were 5 cents for a pack, you know. Comic books were 5 and 10 cents. If you got a paperback, like a lot of the big characters like Tarzan, Conan, and those guys, that you started to get paperbacks of those stories. And they were like 60 cents for a paperback. It really wasn't a lot of money. And you could do a lot of trading, so you could get things that you hadn't read all the time. They were readily available. But as I was saying, parents encouraged their kids to read, and a lot of kids' reading was comic books. And then also, if we'd see a lot of our family, we'd see a lot of cousins. Same, they were from in the East Bay or maybe in the North Bay area. When we came to see them, we would trade our comics with them as well. So it was a fun thing to get a large variety of magazines. And parents, at least my parents, we're not that quick to censor, you know, oh, you can't read this or you can't read that. We were allowed to pretty much read whatever we wanted. And as I was saying a little earlier, some of the far right religious types of folks, I mean, they still exist today comic books are evil. Television is evil. It's going to rot your brain and whatnot. And we didn't have that at home. So we were free to look at whatever we wanted. And so a lot of these, I didn't mention a lot of the ones because they've kind of fallen off the face of the earth. There were all kinds of things out there. Like, there was one called Pogo. It was some sort of an odd swamp creature, and he interacted with all of his friends in a swamp. I mean, that was a little, I thought that, even when I was a kid, I thought that was kind of odd. But some of the stuff is still around. Almost all of it those characters and those comics. Of course, they've made it to the widescreen or to streaming now. I mean, the number of films that have derived from origins back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, they're out there. They're still there. I mean, they're big time, with Marvel and DC and all the other things that are out made into movies what we call now franchises. You know, they're just a ton of them that are out there. When I look at things like The Mandalorian and some of the other kinds of shows, I mean, that's just one that comes to mind immediately. I kind of see those as their roots were in comics. I mean, the George Lucases and Spielbergs and a lot of the other people in film, those guys were reading, a lot of them are my age or close to my age. They were doing the same thing. They were coming up with comics. We started in the late 60s when we were in college. We came across Dungeons and Dragons. It was just getting off the ground. Well, that's sword and sorcery. That's based on pulp fiction and comics coming out of the 30s and 40s and early 50s. And I mean, Dungeons and Dragons is what, a multi-billion-dollar industry in itself now. Of course, both my brothers were involved with this stuff. All of our friends. My mom tried to convince us because there were comics that were the old classics. So you had Tale of Two Cities and all of the classic literature from the Western, from France, England, Germany, and Western Europe and whatnot. All of those, and then also the American literature that came up in the 17th, 18th, 19th century, Last of the Mohicans, things like that. There were comics for all of that stuff. It wasn't just silly kind of things like Pogo in the swamp. There was all, or Woody Woodpecker used to scare me. I mean, that guy was violent. He was really nasty. There were so many things available to us. You never got tired of it. You never got bored with it because there was so much material out there. And if you like science fiction, or if you liked Westerns, or if you liked detectives, or if you liked, Archie, I'm not sure where that fits in. That's just comic relief, you know? Mm-hmm. Or I suppose it teaches some social skills, I guess, as well. You know, the trials and tribulations of being a teenager. But those are the kinds of things that filled our lives back in the 50s and 60s. In the late 60s, when I went to San Jose State University, right across the street was a comic book store that was pretty good size. It was called Bob Sidebottom's Comics. And of course, Bob Sidebottom was the proprietor. And when I went in there, that's when I saw Conan and Cole the Conqueror and Conan the Barbarian, both Robert E. Howard characters. And Bob Sidebottom, I got to know him pretty well. And I go in and say, well, what's new this week? And he goes, you gotta get this stuff. And so I still have the first 65 or 70, maybe 75 issues of Conan. And after 13 episodes, Cole the Conqueror stopped. And I don't know if that series ever resurrected, but he was similar to a Conan kind of a character. Maybe that's why he disappeared, because he competed with Conan. But the thing that I remember was the cover art. It was Frank Frazetta. And Frank Frazetta is masterful. I mean, there's a lot of copycats now, and there's a lot of people. He influenced a lot of people to do that kind of that style of artwork. My first apartment that I had when I was 20 in 1970, all of the walls had Frazetta posters of Conan, and they were the comic book cover. Mm-hmm. If you buy those same posters today, they're $300 or $400 each, and Frazetta original paintings go for well over $1 million each now. But Frazetta was fantastic. So Bob Sidebottoms was a victim of urban renewal. San Jose, downtown San Jose at that time was disintegrating, and people were moving to the suburbs and out of the city of San Jose. And if you go down there now, it's beautiful because they've spent the last 40 or 50 years doing renovations and whatnot. But unfortunately, Bob Sidebottom's little comic book store was a casualty probably around, I would guess around 1973 or four. But I love that place. I'd spend, between classes, I'd go down there and spend time because you probably know with college classes, sometimes you have an hour or two between classes. And I was living in Sunnyvale. I didn't want to drive all the way back to Sunnyvale and then come back to San Jose just for an afternoon class. Then I had to go to work in the evening. So I'd hang out in the comic book store. And the big difference between Bob Sidebottom's comic book store and Pete's Smoke Shop, if you went into Pete's Smoke Shop, now this is early to mid-50s, there's a big, huge sign on the wall, don't read the magazines. And so, you could look at the covers, but you couldn't read the magazine. And if you did, you had to buy it. So, you had a limited budget, so, you had to be careful. And then also the guy sitting behind the counter would yell at you, too. You might even get banned. If you read the magazines too much, they'd just kick you out, and they'd remember who you were, and they wouldn't let you in. So, all the grocery stores had comic books, but not like at Pete's Smoke Shop. Whereas Bob Sidebottom had tables and coffee and tea and crap like that. And you could sit down and read whatever you wanted. And he didn't care if you bought it or not. He was very, I think he with recreational drugs probably made him pretty mellow. The other thing that I remember, I just came into my head, was about that time Ronald Reagan was the governor of California. And he decided he could save money by closing down a lot of the mental hospitals that were around the state. And so these people would go into halfway houses after they got out of the nut house or the loony bin or whatever you call it. That probably sounds derogatory, but that's what we used to call it when we were college kids. Anyway, the halfway houses were former fraternity and sorority houses around the San Jose State campus. In the late 60s and early 70s, frat houses and sororities, the amount of people joining those things really dropped because it wasn't cool. So there's all these empty buildings. So the state would rent these old ramshackle houses, and the people that were getting out of the facilities would live in these halfway houses. So you'd have all these schizophrenic people and people that, that were on meds and whatnot, wandering around the campus. And they'd also wandered into Bob Sidebottom's, and they liked the comics too. But it wasn't unusual in the wintertime, if you were sitting in a class, the door would open and, a couple of homeless people or guys from the halfway house would wander in and sit down and fall asleep because it was warm inside the rooms, the classrooms. So I've talked a long time. I'll pause for a second and see if you have some questions or you want to interject or what you want to talk about at this time.
So first thing is I pulled up Bob Sidebottom's Comic Collector Shop on Facebook.
Yeah.
There's a Facebook page for it. It says it's a tribute page for Bob Sidebottom, who lived November 2nd, 1935. until September 29th, 1993. And the comic collector shop, which was open from November of 1968 until September 2nd of 1996. And there's all these different photos of people who, you know, they're sharing photos from the 70s and the 80s of the collector shop. And so I'm looking at it here now. Here's a picture of Bob himself organizing some of his tables with some long boxes and everything. Cool. It's pretty cool.
So it lasts, that's, does it say if it was at the same location?
I'm seeing some pictures, and all of these pictures, these actually look fairly recent, and okay. It looks to be in the same place, because the building, you know, the locations next to it and all that all seem to be the same as the pictures I'm seeing from the 70s.
Okay, so maybe, like, yeah, maybe it managed to survive the urban renewal projects. So that's great. I'm glad to hear that.
Well, close to a college, he probably always had, you know, young nerds coming in and keeping his business afloat.
Oh yeah, there's no question that that he started. You know, a lot of his customers would be people roughly my age, maybe a little younger, maybe a little older, that grew up with comics. So it was a great shop. It was a really cool place.
Dang, it's too bad that you thought it closed down, because I bet you would have taken us all there.
Oh, yeah.
Although the shop that we would go to in Milpitas, Pendragon Comics, which I think I've looked that one up and it's also still open. I only remember being there a couple of times, but that was a pretty cool shop as well.
Yeah, it was a nice place. I really liked it. I couldn't believe the first time we went in there. It just knocked the wind out of my sails, because my recollection of comics from the early 50s through the late 60s, and then seeing, you know, 20 years later going into that shop, the volume, the quantity, the quality, the fantastic artwork, it was just incredible to see. I was dumbfounded. I didn't think anything like that would exist, and there it was. And now, of course, we know they're all over the place.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're everywhere now. Just being able to read these comics in the 50s and 60s, it's comics that, you know, people in my generation, the generation above mine, you know, Gen X and millennials, we grew up reading all these comics in the Bronze Age and in the Modern Age and everything. After the comics started getting more serious and started taking themselves more seriously, you know, in the 70s. So for us, we're looking at all of these comics through this modern lens, where all of these superheroes are taken seriously and they have these darker storylines. And then just being able to trace all of that stuff back to, like, the mid-50s, when superhero comics really started to boom, even more than they had been. Obviously, you have the DC heroes, Superman and Batman, you know, Aquaman and Wonder Woman had been around since the 40s as well. Whereas over on the Marvel side, there wasn't really a whole lot. Captain America, the original Human Torch that was the android guy, you had Namor the Submariner. Most of those comics that were being published by Atlas and those other companies that predated Marvel Comics, they didn't have all the big heroes until the 60s. It's just interesting to hear you're naming all these names of comics that I wouldn't say are defunct now, but they're definitely not ones that stood the test of time. I mean, even nowadays, we still look at, I feel like people in my generation and maybe a few older and a few younger, the last time Conan was relevant was, you know, the Schwarzenegger movies from the 70s and 80s, you know, and Call the Conqueror, I think, had like one revival film in the 90s and it just didn't catch on, a lot of those things. Flash Gordon, you know, the last time he was relevant was the 80s. So it's just interesting to hear what were the big heroes and stories that captured your imagination, and only seeing really the ones that made it through were the DC superheroes.
So Flash Gordon, I want to say in the 80s, they had a film that came out, and Queen did the soundtrack.
Yep.
And, yep, that was the first time I had ever heard music by Queen, and it just knocked my socks off. It was so, so good. And it worked so well with that movie. The movie was kind of done in a campy kind of a way, but it was mm-hmm. still fun. I don't know if you've ever seen it, or if you're familiar with it at all. Max von Sydow, who's a great award-winning Swedish, I think, actor that for decades and decades played the evil villain, nasty guy. A lot of the comics that I grew up with are long gone, you know, unless you go on eBay or some other online place to see if you can get them. A lot of the offshoot of comics was the paperback, the paperbacks that came out. You know, if you can go into any bookstore now, you know, you go you'll still find a lot of those out. And of course, the Dungeons and Dragons stuff, which I still see as an extension of Pulp Fiction, sword and sorcery is what they called that genre. It's alive now in a multi-billion dollar industry. And of course the films are amazing. I cannot keep up with it. There's so much material that's out on streaming now mostly Marvel because Disney, but I think DC, there's still a lot of DC stuff out there now, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah, they're still making live action movies. They're still doing animated series and shows. They have on the Max streaming platform, they've got all the DC stuff since Warner Brothers owns DC Comics now. You find all of that stuff on there. I feel like over the last 10 or 15 years or so, the DC stuff hasn't been as warmly regarded as the Marvel stuff that we've seen. But there's a lot of the DC stuff that they're putting out now that I think I preferred even to a lot of the Marvel stuff. There were a couple of shows on the CW network, you know, which is well known as a very cheesy, kind of a corny network, you know, low budgets. And
right. Low budget is the word or the phrase that I would think of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the CW. And they have a lot of like corny over-dramatized stuff, but they had their own little universe of DC shows that were based on Green Arrow, Supergirl, and my personal favorite of them was The Flash. And that really kind of kick-started my love for the character, and The Flash has kind of become my favorite DC character, even more so than Batman. I grew up always aware of Superman and Batman. Again, thanks to – we had some of the Max Fleischer cartoons on VHS, and then, of course, the Adam West Batman. We had a couple of tapes, I think, where you just recorded, you know, random episodes that were on. So I was always able to kind of watch those. But the DC heroes never really kind of grabbed my attention. I don't know if it was like they just weren't modern enough, or maybe it was just because the X-Men cartoon just sucked me in, and, you know, Janae and Ariana always seemed to have – X-Men stuff. But I started getting into DC Comics myself like around 2000 when my buddy Lucas handed me it was a four-part story called Kingdom Come, and it was this really gorgeous artwork from a painter named Alex Ross, just fantastic artwork, and it was written by Mark Waid, and that really is kind of what sucked me into reading DC Comics. And from there, I became just a really big Batman fan. So for, you know, the first 15 years or so of the new millennium, I was more of a Batman fan than any other comic character or anything. And then when the Flash series came out, it really encouraged me to go back and start reading a lot more Flash comics. And I think the Flash has kind of overtaken Batman as my favorite DC character. And he was the character that really kicked off the Silver Age of comics. So all of the superhero comics that you were able to read, Dad, growing up in the 50s, even continuing into the Marvel heroes like Spider-Man and stuff, that kind of era of comics was started in 1956 when DC Comics relaunched their Flash series, and it was written by Gardner Fox, and it was awesome. I've even gone back and read some of those old 50s and 60s Flash comics, and they are like head and shoulders above anything else that was DC or even Marvel as far as like relevance to today's comics. Like it for me, it's hard to sit down and read 60s Marvel comics, you know, the era of Stan Lee, the birth of Marvel. It's hard for me to sit down and read those old Avengers comics, the old Spider-Mans, the old Fantastic Four, even the old X-Men. Like those are really hard reads for me. They don't read like modern comics. They're very much a product of their time. Conversely, you go over and you look at the Flash comics from the 1950s. They had much less narration. There was much less campy dialogue being said among the characters. There was still silly aspects, you know, being able to hold his entire costume and his little ring and all that. I mean, there were still comics, and it was still the 1950s and 60s, so you still get a lot of that silliness, but it was dealing with really interesting ideas, and it was kind of at the cutting edge of physics and theoretical physics and everything, and everything that kind of changed our way as a species of looking at science in this new age, you know, in these modern ages of the science that we have now. And I feel like Flash was really on the pulse for that whole thing.
You were talking about Spider-Man a little bit. One of my college roommates, Rake Hadlick, Spider-Man was like the center of this guy's universe. He had, at the time I was a roommate with him, which I would say would have been 1970 to 1972, his big quest was to collect a copy of every Spider-Man issue ever published. And at that time, it was in the hundreds. So I kind of overdosed on Spider-Man when I was roommates with him. And I didn't really want to do too much with Spider-Man again until you and your sons got involved with the comics in the last few years, mostly through film. I don't know that the boys read comic books. I imagine that they if they're going to do reading of comic books, it'll be a streaming service. But Ray had this huge, huge collection. At that time, for some reason, this is like 70, 72, for some reason I got interested in the Justice League again, and I was reading a lot of that, which is DC, as I recall.
Yep.
But Flash I always liked. Flash was one of my favorites. I enjoyed Flash.
Yeah, the CW television series is worth checking out. It's its own continuity. It's not adapting, you know, issue by issue, episode by episode of any particular era of Flash history. It kind of just takes what it wants from all eras of the Flash history, and it kind of melds it into one coherent story that's its own separate thing. But it does draw a lot from Gardner Fox's run as the writer of the Flash. And I haven't read everything from 1956 until 1984, but I'm pretty sure that Gardner Fox wrote the Flash for most of that era. I don't think it was the full nearly 30 years of the Flash, but he wrote a long time, and just introduced so many interesting concepts to DC Comics overall that even to this day are still staples of DC. You know, we're kind of in this new golden age, we're looking back at superhero movies of the past few years, and that's more the gilded age even than a golden age, as we're starting to see fandom of these movies beginning to dwindle and people being less and less interested in comics just as a whole right now. But a lot of these things that are staples of current day comics and movies, like, You look at the Spider-Man animated movies that are coming out right now, and it's multiverse stuff. You look at the Marvel movies, it's multiverse stuff. You look at the DC movies, everything is multiversal right now. And Gardner Fox's Flash run, he actually was the first person that introduced the idea of a multiverse within DC Comics. And that was all the way back in, I think it was like 1961. I forget which issue. It's the really famous Flash of Two Worlds story. I don't remember what issue number it is. I want to say it's like 123, I think, off the top of my head. But like even back then, you look at these concepts and they were being introduced because of that Silver Age.
The time you're talking about in 61, I mean, that was 20 years. I think he introduced Flash around 1939, 1940, somewhere around there. Because I remember reading it in the early 50s. It wasn't big. It was hard to find. You know, there weren't as many of them. So you're saying in the 60s he created the first of the multiverse kind of concept.
Yeah, well, so the Flash that was introduced back in close to 1940, it was like 39 or 40, somewhere around there when Flash was introduced, that was a character named Jay Garrick. And he was the Flash for quite a while. He was the Flash as part of like the Justice Society, which is a precursor to the Justice League. And then in 1956, they relaunched Flash with a brand new character taking on the mantle of the Flash, and that was Barry Allen. Okay. And so Gardner Fox then continues the story of Barry Allen. And in 1961, the Flash of Two Worlds, that was the multiverse where Barry Allen manages to break some barrier while he's traveling at super speed, and he enters an alternate universe. And he actually goes into Jay Garrick's universe. And Jay Garrick, the original Flash, and Barry Allen as the Flash, they actually have to team up and fight this villain who had been, like, erasing worlds of the multiverse.
So, then, when I was a big Superman fan back in the 50s, some of the things I did not like was in the late 50s, they had a bizarro Superman in a bizarro world. Do you remember any of that?
Oh, yeah. Bizarro is still a big major character in Superman mythos, even in stories being told today. There's a TV series that's currently going on called Superman and Lois. And I believe Bizarro was the villain. He was like the overarching villain for the entire second season.
I was wondering if it was still around, because I lost contact with it in the 60s.
Yeah, Bizarro is still a big Superman character.
That's weird. And that was I don't know if you'd call it a multiverse. It was certainly an alternate universe that that Superman crossed over and had to deal with all of those bizarro characters. For some reason, I just never liked it. It just seemed, I don't know, I couldn't get my head around it.
Yeah, there's some interesting stuff going back and looking at 50s and 60s Superman comics, even going back and looking at the Superman comics in the 40s. You know, the Lex Luthor that we have in Superman comics of the present day, very different than the Lex Luthor that we had back in those times, and, you know, the golden and silver ages of comics. Lex Luthor back then would mostly be portrayed almost as like a mad scientist,
yes.
Whereas modern day Lex Luthor is, you know, a ruthless, savvy businessman who uses his wealth and, you know, business acumen to put himself in situations where he can oppose Superman and show, you know, Earthlings that they don't need to look to the stars for, you know, human excellence and that sort of thing. And it's almost more of philosophical differences and jealousy rather than just being some like evil mad scientist guy who's doing evil things for the sake of doing them.
Well, the evolution of comic book characters over the decades is an interesting topic, because they really, a lot of characters have evolved and changed around quite a bit.
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes more from the villains as the writers and artists were able to begin to tell more mature and more nuanced stories. They really were able to dive in and develop their villains in ways that you didn't get in the more serialized versions of comics in the early days. And as your villains grow and evolve, then that gives your heroes opportunities to grow and evolve as well, come up with alternate, you know, reasons for their ideologies and things like that. You know, you look at Batman comics from the 1940s, and he's got machine guns on the Batmobile, and he's got his, you know, bat pistols and stuff, and he's not afraid to, you know, pump some of these criminals full of lead when they step a toe out of line. But nowadays we have a Batman who doesn't kill, because it's the one thing that sets him apart from the criminals themselves. And so we have these new ideals of what a hero is supposed to be, and it allows them to be opposites of their, you know, more villainous counterparts.
Pardon me. You know, you had mentioned a while ago, I think it was the Superman animated Fleischer comics that I think were in the 40s, where he was fighting the Nazis and he's fighting the Japanese and whatnot. As were a lot of the comics in the 40s got introduced as propagandized characters during World War II. Less so in the Cold War, although you did see some of it. I think where the especially not so much the Russians as the what we used to call the Chai Coms or the Red Chinese, you know, the people that are the manufacturing center of the world now. But I don't remember you mentioning, as you were growing up, noticing anything with propaganda. I know when you were small and your sisters were small, you guys were really, really interested in comics. You loved going to the comic book store. I mean, you'd look around and go, whoa, you know, you guys were kind of like me. There was so much out there. But what was it that caught your eye when you were a little guy? What were the comics that you really, really enjoyed?
Yeah, I think even more so than comic books themselves were the trading cards. You know, I remember Janae and Ariana just having all these albums of, you know, stickers and everything. And then when they started collecting trading cards, that was something that really got me into it. So we had X-Men trading cards and we had Marvel trading cards of all the various Marvel superheroes. I think that for me kind of predates me buying and collecting and reading comics. But thinking back to like my collection that I had as a kid and stuff that I still have to this day, it's mostly X-Men. But as far as like Marvel heroes, I would get Spider-Man and Captain America and like Ghost Rider. I remember having a lot of comics of each of those heroes. And I actually remember this camping trip that we had gone on. If you remember, we would have our annual camping trips up to Shaver Lake and Dinky Creek up there.
Dinky Creek, yeah.
And the first comic book that I ever remember buying, you know, with my own money sort of thing, not one that like Janae or Ariana had given me or that you had picked up for me at a store or whatever, one that I had picked out myself, this would have been in the summer of 1992, at the campsite there, they had, you know, a little bait and tackle shop for the people that would go fishing over at Shaver Lake. And
you could rent a shower.
Yeah. Yeah. With warm water.
Yeah.
And everything.
Yeah.
But in addition to that, they had a little convenience area. You know, you're coming up camping, things spoil, things go, you forget things at home or whatever.
Right.
So you need to have the opportunity to buy, you know, maybe you have to buy some charcoal because you forgot to bring the charcoal or kerosene or whatever. You didn't bring enough ice for your cooler or whatever it was. And, you know, they would have canned goods and, you know, bags of potato chips and stuff.
Right.
And
I remember the back, place very well.
Yeah. In the back room there at that little store, they had a couple of chest freezers for bags of ice and ice cream treats. Well, in that little room, they had a small, like, newsstand. And at this newsstand, they had a pretty big collection of comics. I remember there being Batmans and Supermans and other stuff. And the one that stood out to me that I bought and that I still own, and I even did a special episode covering this storyline, was a Captain America comic. It was Captain America 408, and it was Man and Wolf, part 4 of 6. So it was the fourth issue of a 6-part story. And on this cover is Captain America, and he's holding his shield up like in the foreground, and it's casting a shadow on his head. But the outline of his head is a werewolf head. And over the course of this story, Captain America was turned into a werewolf for like 6 issues. And that story, I don't know why, but I've always loved werewolves. I liked my cat. Of all the heroes that weren't X-Men that I had in my trading cards, Captain America was my favorite one. Probably because, you know, he's American and patriotism and all that sort of thing. I've always just kind of liked Captain America, and seeing him as a werewolf, you know, 7-year-old me was like, holy cow, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. And so I would read Captain America. I ended up tracking down, I think, all but one of those 6 issues. And I think the one that I never had, Ariana had anyway. So I was able to read that whole storyline. Didn't really know what was going on as a kid, referencing all these characters that I didn't know who they were or whatever. But I really liked that story. Growing up as a kid, other than those stories, it was mostly just X-Men comics, I think, because of the X-Men cartoon. I would mostly get those. And then in the mid-90s, when I started getting into Spider-Man because of the Spider-Man cartoon also, then I would start to collect, you know, Amazing Spider-Man's, Venom. Venom always seemed to have a couple of mini-series that were going on, so I would collect those issues as well. And again, yeah, I always liked Ghost Rider. I mean, he was this dude on a motorcycle with a flaming skull for a head. I mean, that was just something that was super cool. Of course, there were other things that I liked that as an adult now I go, oh yeah, well that was from a comic, but I didn't know that they were comics when I was a kid. And that would be like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, G.I. Joe, and Swamp Thing. Those were among my favorite cartoons to watch as a kid, and I don't think I ever realized that they were based on existing comic series. I had no idea.
Right. Now, I remember the trips up to Dinky Creek and going to the little store and getting comics. I remember you guys would buy comics. I remember when you were really little, I think you were about 3, you told me, Janae has too much comics, which in your language meant she has a lot of comics. Mm-hmm. And I remember that the trading cards, I remember you guys collecting those. I remember X-Men. That I always liked X-Men. X-Men just... It, to me, now, at that time, you guys, you know, my children, were introducing these comic books to me. I don't remember X-Men so much when I was young, but I was in my early 40s when you guys introduced me to X-Men. And, 30s or 40s. And I still enjoy the X-Men stories. Those are a lot of fun, but it's like you were saying a moment ago, not so much comic books as the animated series that you'd see on TV, the films that started to come out, the digital games that started coming out. Those were the new phases of comics that I saw, as time has come to where we are now. I mean, I remember
yeah.
you had a Ninja Turtles game, that you were really small. You were young. You were really young. And you would play for a few minutes, and then, you know, your turn would be over. And I'd last about 5 seconds, and you could not figure out, what the heck's wrong with you? What's the matter with you? And those were primitive games, you know. I mean, those were really primitive games when you compare them with what you guys have now.
Yeah, and another thing with the gaming world, we don't even play video games that much anymore over here. Me and the boys have kind of moved into card games and other various tabletop games, and the comic book superheroes have bled their way into those now too. One of the games that we play the most is a game called Marvel United, which is, you know, you play with miniatures and then a small deck of cards. And it's a cooperative game that you play. You know, it's everyone that's sitting at the table is on a team, and you're playing against the game itself that has all these, you know, AI type rules and everything on how the villains activate, so that you can play this full game, even though everyone that's sitting at the table is on a team together. It's really a lot of fun. And then from there, we've moved into another game as well called Marvel Champions. That is it's another cooperative game where everyone at the table is on a team and you're playing against the game itself, which is handled through a villain. But this one is a card-based game where it's a living card game. So there's no, you don't have to go to the store and get booster packs and, you know, cross your fingers and hope that you get the rare card that you're looking for. All of the cards are available retail. It just depends on what you buy. And with that, there's certain rules on how you can build your deck, and you can customize your deck based on whatever the scenario is for the villain that you're playing against. And that has brought such an extra layer of immersion into these worlds that, you know, when you're reading a comic book, you're an observer. You're watching the story take place to other characters. But when you get to play these games, you know, you get to take on the identity of said characters, and it just brings an extra layer of immersion that, you know, this new generation, you know, my sons, I don't even know what generation they are. Gen Alpha, I think I'm hearing, is what, Maxton and Landy are part of now. They're going to be growing up, not necessarily growing up reading comics, but they're going to be growing up immersing themselves in these worlds to a degree that, you know, me and other millennials never even had the opportunity. And we had comics and cartoons and action figures and video games and all of that stuff. But even that, there was a line of demarcation from where these characters ended and we as the children began. You know, the kids are able to just take on these personas now through these games. And it's really been a lot of fun to explore these characters through these different mediums.
Yeah, it's great for me, being, you know, almost 75 years into the comic world, seeing these new avenues and these new possibilities for my grandkids and for their kids. I really love it. I just love it. It's fantastic. But there is one thing that you, and probably more than you, it was Maxton, introduced me to Usagi Yojimbo about, what, 2 or 3 years ago. And I would read, I forget how many series there were on my pad. Mm-hmm. The artwork is spectacular. The storylines are all based on a traditional folk stories from Japan, which you and I are very familiar with because it's an area that we enjoy learning about. The characters are rich, and the storylines are wonderful. And that was something that I experienced all with streaming or with you know, doing it via my pad. Being able to gift Maxton with some of the artwork, you know, it's great. I really, really enjoyed it. For me, having my grandson introduce me to a new character like that, to a new series, it's a wonderful experience.
Yeah, that's really cool. Like you said, you know, 70 years of being a fan of this idea of comic books and still having new things introduced to you, and not even through random external forces, but, you know, younger generations within your own family line. That's pretty cool. I can't wait to be a grandpa and seeing what, you know, my grandkids are going to be able to get into, and seeing things that they'll be able to introduce me to. But yeah, Usagi Yojimbo is fantastic. The cool thing about that is the guy that created the character, he's the same guy that's written, you know, every issue of the series since its inception. He 100% owns his character, and he, you know, he doesn't necessarily do all these issues monthly. You know, this is a story that's been coming out since 1984, so it's a year older even than me. It'll be having its 40th birthday this year, and this, for the last 40 years, this guy has been the sole driving force behind this series, and he tells stories when he wants to and how he wants to, and it's fantastic. To the way that we've seen his approach to storytelling has not changed in 40 years, although it has gotten more rich and more nuanced. And to tie it all back to what you were talking about earlier with Frank Frazetta, I have an autographed issue of Usagi Yojimbo from the most recent volume that was being published by IDW. I think it was like number 17. And I have it's autographed and remarked by Stan Sakai, who's the creator, the writer, the artist on this series. And the cover was a variant cover that was like a con exclusive, and it was based on the Frank Frazetta Wolfman painting that he did, where, you know, you have your hero kind of in the forefront of the picture, and above the hero there's like this rock, and above the rock is this werewolf creature, and the hero is, you know, shocked because he's being ambushed by this werewolf creature. And I have a copy of Usagi Yojimbo where Stan Sakai did an homage to one of Frank Frazetta's most popular paintings. So we're seeing, you know, he's a guy that's of your generation, so he kind of grew up being exposed to the same things that you were, and now I'm showing that to my kids and explaining to them who Frank Frazetta is without even knowing that he was so influential on your fandom. And being so influential in your introduction to the sword and sorcery world, which of course now my sons play D&D, which stem from that. It's fun to see all of these like interconnected generational loops.
And the thing also that I really like is I was telling you how in the 50s there was a pretty concerted effort to get rid of comics. Now we're starting to see museums that are opening. Frazetta's children were the recipients of all of his artwork. And there's more than one. I'm not sure how many of the children have created museums where his original art and other things are being displayed, where people can go in and see how talented these fellows were, these people were. I remember when we went to Comic-Con and we saw kiosks where people, you were talking about how the creator of Usagi, he doesn't answer to a corporation. It's not owned by Disney or any of, you know, some conglomerate. It's his art, and it goes where he wants to take it. When we went to Comic-Con, we saw little kiosks where people were creating their own works, had them published, and were selling them. And there were a lot of them. There were a lot of them. And we stopped off and looked at a bunch. And this is very good stuff. I mean, and that's not just in Denver. It's all over the world. So, you know, the comics are alive and well and expanding and getting better and better. And like you said a moment ago, you're anxious to see where it's going to take you, where where your grandchildren will be when they introduce some new things related to comics, you know, several years from now. It's just wonderful. I really love it. It's fantastic. It's been a big part of my life.
Yeah, and mine as well. And I'm raising my children to be fans of this medium and these ideas. And yeah, I'm just curious to see where it's all going to go in the next 30 or 40 years.
So I can tell you one comical or amusing anecdote. Remember early on in our discussion, I was talking about how my mother would go to the grocery store and once a week and bring back comics for us. And my dad sometimes would, you know, as he was taking the stuff out of the bags, groceries out of the bags, and he'd give us the comics and he'd say, here's your little orphan Annie. I mean, you could hear Papo saying that, you know.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah, well, Papo, if it wasn't a baseball comic, I doubt that he would have much interest in it.
Yeah, I was going to say, we got other things from Papo, you know, a love of baseball, a love of music, and that sort of thing. We might not have gotten our love of comics from him. That might have started with your generation, but there's definitely things that we got from Papo, for sure.
Yeah, well, Papo was quite a character.
All right. Well, I think, we've been talking here for, about an hour or so.
Yeah.
And I think we can probably cut our episode. But I had a really great time, Dad, hearing about your growing up with comics and the different things that pulled you into the medium and how your tastes developed over the years, and everything like that. And just being able to share some of your influence on how that came across in the things that I liked and the things that I've shared with my kids. So I just want to say thank you for sharing your stories, and thank you so much for coming on to the podcast to talk about it with me.
Well, you're welcome, Brian. I've really enjoyed it. It's been really great. I've enjoyed listening to some of your other podcasts with Ariana, with the boys, with your boys. Mm-hmm. And with some of your friends and associates, and it's been great talking about and listening to your other broadcasts about this thing that is such a big part of our lives and how much it's something that we love so much. It's really been a pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on.
Yeah, of course, and maybe we can do it again sometime.
Anytime, you know. It's not like I've got to go to work.
All right. Well, again, Dad, thanks so much for coming on, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
So there you have it, bub. That is my conversation with my dad. I'm super glad to have him on. He's been a listener to the podcast for a long time, but as you could tell, he had a passing knowledge of the X-Men throughout the 60s and 70s and all of that, but X-Men wasn't really a comic that he collected or was super into, and so I never really had a spot for him to come on and talk about one of the cartoon episodes and talk about the comics and that sort of thing. Although, like he did mention, he has gotten into the movies. I know that I think the Wolverine and Logan are his two favorites. And I know that he likes a lot of the earlier ones. But yeah, it was just fun to have him on and get to hear his story about growing up and the different comics that he read throughout the decades. It wasn't really something that was like a big part of my childhood. You know, growing up for me, my dad always indulged my comic fandom. He was always there to pick up a floppy for me or let me get a couple of packs of trading cards or some action figures. And he always encouraged me to read and collect and play and watch the cartoons and all of that. But he never really participated in that with me until I was much older. So it was just fun to go back and have these conversations and hear about the sort of
comics and comic books and things that he was a fan of in his youth. So yeah, I had a great time with him on, and I hope that you all enjoyed the talk. I know that it wasn't really a Wolverine or an X-Men type thing, but I thought it was a fitting episode for Talking Snicked and just something new to try in this new year. Obviously, this is still a Wolverine show, and so I do plan on diving back into Wolverine and X-Men comics. But as I am working on new ideas, my dad reached out with this one, and I thought it was something that I should jump at. And I'm just super glad that he was able to come on and have this conversation. And I hope that you all enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed having it. So with that being said, if you want to follow the show or reach out to me regarding the show in any way, you can send an email to me, talksnicked@gmail.com, talksnicked@gmail.com. Another thing you can do if you're a fan of the show, if you're a fan of Wolverine or X-Men, then click the link in the show notes and come join the Talkin' Snick Discord. It's a small little community, and we have a lot of fun just talking about X-Men, Wolverine, whatever, all kinds of different aspects of the fandom. It's not just comic talk. We talk movies, toys, games, you know, whatever. As long as it's, it doesn't even have to be, but as long as it's, you know, Wolverine and the X-Men centric, we love having those conversations. And there's a few of us that are relatively active in there, mostly various other guest hosts who came on for Saturday morning Snicktoons episodes. So if you liked any of those guests, or if you like Wolverine or the X-Men, then yeah, consider joining the Talkin' Snick Discord. One last thing, something that I've added recently to Talkin' Snicked is not necessarily a voicemail. There's no phone calls necessary as long as you have a device that connects to the internet, which if you're listening to the podcast in the first place, you probably have said device. But there is a link in the show notes as well for a thing called SpeakPipe. And what that does is it lets you leave up to 90 seconds worth of a voicemail. And I would love to hear feedback or kudos, criticisms, just general, you know, hey, how's it going? That sort of thing. If you've ever wanted to get in touch and, you know, an email is too long to type out and you're not really one to join the Discord, but you just want to say something really quick, then yeah, click that link in the show notes for the SpeakPipe and leave me a 90-second voicemail. As soon as one is sent to me, I get an email notification, and I can even download the audio as an MP3 to add to future episodes. So again, if that's something that you think sounds interesting, then yeah, click the link and send me a voicemail. Anyway, that's all I have for now. I am still working on a few things, and as those things fall into place, look for announcements to come. For those of you who listen to Talkin' Snicked, but maybe you haven't been paying attention lately, or you didn't realize that Saturday Morning Snicktoons had recently dropped an episode, X-Men 97, the revival series, the sequel series to X-Men, the animated series, is coming to Disney Plus, and it will be streaming March 20th. I did an episode of Saturday Morning Snicktoons, just me and my sons, and we broke down the trailer and talked about our hopes and dreams for this upcoming series. And if you haven't checked it out, go back and give that a listen. Otherwise, stay tuned as new Saturday Morning Snicktoons episodes will start to drop once this new series finally comes to us. Again, that date was March 20th. Well, until next time, bub.